Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, June 5th, 2014. Many topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking a bit about Mayan astronomy archaeology. And also, I'll be doing some commentary on space weather. What's the standard story of space weather? And what is the real story of space weather? First of all, I want to talk a little bit about the new 1 liter small filter system. I gave away typically in my kitchen, my own personal kitchen, I use the stainless steel standard size water filter, and I use one filter element that's enough for my daily use, etc., in the kitchen. Everything from washing vegetables to fruit, washing fruit to cooking or other, you know, drinking water, mixing with other anything to drink or cooking, etc. That filter provides all of the useful water. I wash dishes with the kitchen water from the tap, but that's about it. And of course, shower with the tap water, etc. But that stainless steel water filter provided all of the kitchen water that had to be filtered. I gave mine away the other day, last week. I gave my filter away to a poor family that didn't have a filter, and I knew I had my 1 liter, the new 1 liter mini filter, travel, personal, sports, emergency filter, if you want to call it that. I had that, and so I said, well, I'll just start using that. That'll be fine just to get by with. And that little filter produced all of the water I needed, and of course you have to keep filling it, was the difference. With the big filter, I filled it one time a day, and that was it. But the little filter, of course, it filters about every hour. It empties out the top container, and I have to refill it. So it's, of course, I wasn't standing there all the time filling it every hour, but quite a bit. I was filling it you know, every couple hours I'd refill it, but that filter provided all of the water I needed in the kitchen, and plus had this two extra storage containers that comes with it. And so, I want to tell you, well, just that's kind of a little plug for that mini filter. It's a very capable little filter. It's, you can travel, it packs together very compact for travel. It comes with an extra filter element in case something happens during travel. If one of them breaks, you still have an extra one. This is really, I'm very happy with this little one. And then also comes in a 2 liter size for people who have a little bit more capacity need. The 2 liter size is just gives you bigger storage capacity. But today I wanted to comment on now, many people out there already have a filter with filter elements, and if you look at these, water around the United States and around the world is getting worse and worse and worse, and it's going to get far worse before it ever gets better. I don't think it'll ever get better. But if you use a filter, take a look at that ceramic filter element after a week, after 2 weeks, after 3 weeks, after a month, and just look at the crud that builds up on the surface. Now, that doesn't count all the chemicals and other things that you can't see that are being filtered out inside the filter. We're just talking about the surface gunk that is filtered out before it ever gets to your filter element. And a lot of people, it's so bad that they actually use the pre-filter to filter their water from, be it whether from a well or be it from a municipal water system. They pre-filter the water before it goes into their water filter, their primary water, gravity water filter, because the water is so filthy. And but what I noticed, and now I a while back I did some studying down in Florida, and I was doing some work regarding chemtrails. And looking at the airplanes, I announced this on a few of my shows where I followed the airplanes that were doing the chemtrail spraying, and these were primarily non-commercial flights. They didn't correspond with the commercial flights that were going on in the area. So they literally were not commercial flights. These are specific to chemtrail spraying, nothing else. Now, imagine somebody has to be putting a very serious investment into airplanes, into maintenance. You don't just fly airplanes around, jet airplanes around, without extreme expense. So somebody is going to extreme expense to spray into the atmosphere. Besides, it has to be okayed with the Air Space Command, who controls literally military, in the military sense, controls all of our airspace. So if they're not commercial flights, and they're flights specifically for spraying, it has to be under the watchful eye of the U.S. military, of which Obama supposedly is commander-in-chief. That's what he says anyway. But anyway, what ends up in your water system in coming out of the tap, whether you're traveling, but the point I wanted to make about Florida is that I was using my travel filter in Florida when I was staying there, and the water in Florida is horrific. I mean, it's unbelievably bad what comes out of that water filter or out of that water tap. And it has to be filtered. There's just no question about it. And this is true almost all over the United States. This past week, Portland, Oregon, or like about this past week, I believe it was, they had to have a ban on using the city water. They had E. coli and other serious bacteria in the water supply in Portland. And so they put out an emergency announcement. The people had to either boil their water or buy bottled water. Well, of course, how many people can stand there and boil water? And even if they do, how can they make sure that they're going to get all of the E. coli killed and other bacteria? But the strange thing was that this is not the first time this has happened in Portland. And Portland just can't seem to figure out where this E. coli is coming from. Well, typically, E. coli would come from feces, from human feces. But if they're, they're these ponds that they have, these holding ponds for the water, don't have access. It's not like you can jump over and go swimming. And so you can't blame it on the neighbor's dog or the kids down the street going swimming. So the question is, how is E. coli getting into the Portland water supply? And they just can't figure it out. Well, I came up with a possible solution. The Nestle's company and the Coca-Cola company, Pepsi Bottling, whoever it might be, just doing a little progressive marketing, you might call it. Maybe the people in Portland weren't buying their fair share of bottled water, and so if you put E. coli in the water supply, the city sends out the emergency notice, everybody runs out, and there was a run on bottled water. They sold out in a day in Portland. All the bottled water was gone. So at any rate, this is getting serious, everybody. You cannot be without your own independent source of fresh water. That means a gravity filter, and I sell countertop filters that go hook into the city water supply, into the faucet. But that is an emergency, and other people might sell that type of filter. Do not depend on that for an emergency water filter. It is not an emergency water filter. It has to be a gravity feed like the kind I sell to be emergency. Okay, well, I'm just going to jump off of that topic, but it's very important to have your own source of filtered water and understand that even if it's not an emergency, what is coming out of your tap is horrible. Just a little anecdote. Yesterday I was talking to a doctor. He's a medical doctor. And he said that if they take tap water from the tap and give it to their dogs and cats, they will not drink it. They have to feed them filtered water. Then they drink a lot of water, but if you put a bowl of water in front of one of their animals, the dogs or cats, they will not drink the water. Is that incredible? I just found that to be an amazing story. Just a little note here. Yesterday morning, as with most Wednesday mornings, I'm a guest, regular guest on the John Moore Show. And oddly enough, yesterday John had a tremendous storm. You could hear the thunder in the background as he was trying to proceed with the show. And so John had to sign off. And I told him, yeah, unplug all your equipment, you know, get everything offline, unplug everything, pull the lines out of the wall. Because he has, of course, his equipment there that could be damaged by lightning. So anyway, he did, and I finished the show, John's show, myself. And so that was a very interesting situation. But I was talking about the banking conditions, and since I went through quite a bit of that on John's show yesterday, I'll do rather a summary of that because I want to get into some science topics. But first of all, I want to let you know, I pre-announced this topic on my webpage this past week. I was going to talk about the financial conditions that go all the way up to the president, which is bringing this country into a housing crisis of unprecedented size and scope. And here is what it amounts to. And by the way, let me, before I go into detail here, I want you to understand what the end solution is. We have to basically get rid of the world banking system. And that's a monster of just beyond Goliath proportions. It spans the world governments. It controls the United States military. It controls the United States government through the Federal Reserve, through the Internal Revenue Service, which has its hooks into every American. It's just unbelievable the scope of control. They are, through LLCs, they own oil, they own water now. The scope of control of the world banking system is unbelievable. They have their way of getting into every third world country in the world and basically stealing the resources, gaining control of the resources through phony loan systems through the World Bank. But in the United States, there's two things that are happening right now that are going to, just as the final nail in the coffin for the United States, that the housing crash of a couple of years ago is just nothing compared to what's about to happen. Obama has on his desk a bill that was passed by the Senate and the House. It's waiting to be signed, but it's leaving the country in financial limbo. Here's the situation. The bill relieves homeowners of any tax obligation if their house goes into foreclosure, short sale, or even if they sell it and for an amount less than what they owe the bank, they would have to pay the bank. But if they cannot pay the bank, then basically in those scenarios, primary short sales and foreclosures, they are liable for income, the difference between the equity in the house and the loan, the loan, and for foreclosures, that's the entire loan value. So people are going to be, here you have people who can't even make their house payment. And if they go into foreclosure or short sell the house, they are going to then end up owing the IRS the difference between the short sale and the loan value, or in the case of foreclosure, the entire loan value. They are going to owe the IRS taxes on that as if it were income in a single year. Now, first of all, it's an insane regulation. It's an IRS regulation. But how can a house that's lost value be deemed as income? It's absurd. If you have an investment in the stock market, just like a home is an investment, if the stocks lose value, you don't pay taxes on the difference between what you paid for the stock and what the stock is worth now. That's not income. How in the world can you claim that's income? It's insane. But they have done this on housing. And so from about 2007 to 2012, there was a law that was passed. It was called the Homeowner Protection Act or something like that, that protected homeowners from having to pay that tax. They still got a 1099 form, but they didn't have to pay the tax. it into 2013, shortly after 2013 began, Obama signed it. But now into 2014, he has not signed that bill extending it into 2014. So beginning last September or August, people have not been short selling or foreclosing their homes. This builds up a bubble, and a vast bubble of foreclosures and short sales. And believe me, they're out there because the people can simply no longer pay on these. So there's an estimated 300,000 to 500,000 homes that are sitting there waiting to go into foreclosure. Well, Obama is protecting the banks and the LLCs that have purchased the prior wave of foreclosures. They purchased those for pennies on the dollars, and they were hoping to artificially hold the value of homes up so they could dump it at current or previous home value prices. What's happening is they're dribbling them out into the market one at a time, hoping to get their money back. But there is currently a pent up housing foreclosures, probably up to 500,000 houses sitting there vacant around the country, and there's another 500,000 houses ready to come on the market. Now, these are round numbers, but it's horrendous. Now, if Obama signs this bill, that will immediately plunge the value of houses so the banks can no longer charge market value for foreclosed homes. And the same with the LLCs. So he's protecting them. It's a form of collusion between the president and the banks. If he signs the bill, then all of these houses will come on the market in overnight. Hundreds of thousands of houses going into foreclosure overnight. It will be on top of the houses that are already sitting around the country vacant, that they have not been put on the market, that are sitting there while the bank onesie and twosies sets the houses out from the foreclosure backlog into the market, trying to get full market value. And the same with the LLCs. But if Obama does not sign it, it's like a balloon. It's a balloon that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger every day. And that balloon, my friends, will break because the economy is done. I mean, there are no jobs. People can't keep paying on these. So people individually will start going under. They simply cannot hold out any longer. It's like a swimmer in the middle of the ocean trying to swim towards shore, but there's still 100 miles to go, and he can only go two more miles. That's what's going to happen. And all of these, this balloon is going to blow apart sky high. And at that place, all of these people, these American people, public homeowners that have mortgages, are going to fall into the clutches of the IRS and owe immense amounts of taxes. And so you can see what's going on here. This is the last chess move for the people that there's two things that happen. It's driving away home ownership from the public, because when this next wave of foreclosures hits, the housing prices will plummet. There will not be a single person that can survive it, and everybody will be dumped into this IRS tax scenario. IRS tax debt scenario, where they owe, how can you pay $50,000 in IRS taxes if you can't make $1,000 a month house payment? Obviously, that's insane. So, okay, without going into more detail, couple that with the July 1st, when Congressional Bill H.R. 2847 goes into effect. I believe I have that number right, but that's the one where the IRS now has the ability to go into foreign banks and require them to report on Americans, American businesses, anything American in those foreign banks, and withhold money and pay it to the IRS in the United States. Well, the whiplash effect of this, of course, is these banks have shut down anything American. It is a gridlock. American individuals, corporations, and LLCs, any business deals, anything with Americans has been stopped. There is no more. It's like putting a self-inflicted boycott on the American, on the United States. I mean, I don't know if Obama is this stupid in Congress, but obviously this is a plan. This is shutting down the United States. Couple that with Russia just signed a big oil deal with China because it is no longer going to be selling oil to Europe or the United States. And so Russia, being a big exporter of natural gas and oil, is going to move those products off into other parts of the world. So the United States has basically put itself in a self-embargo situation with the economy collapsing. The United States is already economically toast. But, okay, I'm not going to talk anymore about that. The reason that's important is because you can prepare for this simply by you have to get out of any mortgage debt and stay there. The only people that are going to be safe for a while anyway will be people who own private property, but the whiplash effect there is that the banks do not pay taxes on the bulk property that they own that's in foreclosure. So real estate taxes will go up, homeowner association fees will go up as more and more houses go into foreclosure and these people fall through the cracks. You can go through most housing developments in the country and probably 10% of the houses are for sale. That's the condition. People are just, they can't take it anymore financially. They see the end coming. They just want to make some kind of move to get out. But most people will be trapped. Okay, enough of that. I want to talk about a little bit about energy. We have technologies that are available which could solve the energy crisis, and that's all I'm going to say for right now about that. There's things that are going on in the background. There are technologies that are starting to come to light. One of them I saw was a very interesting project, was funded by the public, where they actually had big tiles, and these were snapped together to create a road, and so it created the road became the solar connector or solar collector of electrical energy. And that was very interesting, because if you had electric cars, that's exactly where you'd be using the energy. So the road would be basically a solar panel that you drove on. A very interesting concept. But this was funded by public input, individuals putting in small amounts of money, and they had raised up over $1 million and were actually installing these for test systems. But clearly the world has to be changed. And I'll just go back to the original thing I said at the beginning of the show. All of this destruction, chaos, economic collapse, destruction of world resources, the unabated use of world resources to support a dying economic model, to support a military in the U.S. that is just enormous in consuming vast amounts of resources, plus couple that with the use of energy that is unnecessary. First of all, we don't need coal, oil, or nuclear, never did. And the amount of energy that's being used to sustain this unsustainable society, all coming crashing down. It is all 100% attributable to the world banking model, which just supports the ultra rich. And it does it at the expense of everybody else. That banking model was done away with in the Old Testament. You see the ancient books where they talk about the usury fees and exactly everything that's going on today. This isn't the first time this has happened. This has happened before in history, and it was outlawed. These people have a way of coming back and getting back into the governments, into the banking system, into the lives of people. And the only solution, now what I've said before, and actually I have a plan instead of just talking about this, here is my plan. What you do is we get chain link fence companies from all over the country. We load up their chain link fence equipment, installation equipment, and from all parts of the country, they converge on Washington, D.C., and Wall Street. They start to put up chain link fence around Washington, D.C., and every contributor puts his name on it. We have little old ladies, we have little old men, we have kids, we have cousins, we have aunts and uncles, we have families, and we have militia who are going in to guard this operation where we put a fence around Washington, D.C., we put a fence around Wall Street and all of the financial centers, of banking centers of the New York, California, wherever they are, and we make them into a giant prison. Okay? They become prisons. Nobody can get out. Those people are now imprisoned. We shut down the banking system and get back to the banking system, the original constitutional banking system. And we block the airports. Nobody can fly out. This is an operation that simply then the United States public elects a new presidential leadership. Let's put them in the middle of Kansas. We'll build a new capital in the middle of Kansas, not at Colorado. All of the known secret installations, Area 51, the installations up in Idaho, the installations around the Colorado-Denver airport become prisons. And you shut down this immense operation that's going on in the world today and get back to where people can live normal lives. We break the housing crisis. We put people back in their homes. We have to reverse what's going on, and then there's going to have to be great planning the ability to get food and supplies to the population and start growing non-GMO food, start recuperating the lands that have been destroyed through the entire central part of the United States to grow organic, non-GMO food. This is an immense effort that has to be started. If not, this country is just going, we have to stop polluting the water systems, start letting them recuperate over time. That's the only possible solution, but it has to start by destroying in the United States the banking system and the government that has allowed those banking systems to exist. Okay, enough of that. I'm going to go talk about science tonight. And I got a kick out of there's a government website. It's called SOHO. It deals with the solar observatory that is in outer space between Earth and the Sun. And they had a little video that's supposed to teach the public what space weather is. Now, one would imagine that that would be somewhat informative. But all they talk about are the aurora borealises. Now, it's very comical to listen to this because they talk about magnetic fields. And they start out with the complete misinformation. They say that this starts at the sun, and they say that sun's energy starts at the core of the sun, which is total misinformation. And then they say that the heat from the sun comes up and it creates electrical currents at the surface of the sun. Now, absolute impossible fairy tale science. How can the light that's emanating evenly throughout the atmosphere of the sun, if that's in fact what was going on, create electrical currents? It's just so bizarre and so absurd that then they say, well, that creates magnetic fields, and sometimes these magnetic fields come out of the sun, and then little bubbles break away, magnetic bubbles, magnetic, magnetic, magnetic. Well, then they get where this magnetic bubble of plasma hits Earth, And once again, they say, oh, this creates field lines, magnetic field lines that create another bubble. And then all of a sudden, this magical current comes flowing into Earth and causes the auroras. Fairy tale science. But of course, the one thing that they never, ever talk about is the real source of all of this, is the fact that there are electric fields in outer space, that the electrical currents don't just magically flow along magnetic field lines. They have no reason to flow along magnetic field lines unless there's a voltage, unless there's an electrical potential that causes them to move. So just amazing. So anyway, I want to concentrate on what exactly is the source of Earth weather in just a kind of a mini-series, and I cover this many times on my show. So I'm going to, and also this is in my books, in my DVDs, etc., but I want to cover this topic just in somewhat of a nutshell kind of explanation. So basically, the fusion of the sun is at the surface of the sun. It's in the atmosphere. The core of the sun is cool. It's a planetary type of core, and it's much cooler than the atmosphere. The fusion in the atmosphere of the sun is caused by electrical storms in the atmosphere. It's like an electrical fire of hydrogen burning to become helium, and this all occurs in the atmosphere of the sun. Because the sun does not have enough atmosphere to keep this process going forever, it depends on a constant influx of hydrogen from outside of our solar system. This is the same source of hydrogen that mixes with oxygen that becomes water in the tail of comets. So at any rate, when I was working with the Russians back in the mid-1990s, they were very interested in my work because it explained what they were seeing. They were taking observations of the edge of the solar system, the region where the influence of the sun ends and the intergalactic space begins. And what they were noticing were these electrical front out there. And that's exactly what is going on, because the sun is acting just like a large comet. It's discharging the galactic capacitor, which is caused by the same effect. Protons leaving a fusion-based star system in the center of the galaxy. It's all exactly the same, and that's the source of the hydrogen that comes in towards the sun. So you see that all of these electrical concepts join together. They show you how the sun works in the galaxy. They show you how the surface of the sun, the fusion that's at the surface of the sun, is replenished on a constant basis. And, of course, that can vary. That's one of the factors, one of the many, many, many factors affecting our weather, because our weather comes directly from the sun. If the sun were to turn off, 8 minutes later, the Earth would go dark and we would start to plummet into endless freeze nighttime. And within a couple days, we would be plummeting past freezing, and everything on Earth, eventually the atmosphere would rain out of the sky, fall down on the surface of the Earth, and we would be left as an ice-cold planet with an icy surface, but no atmosphere. That's what would happen if the sun all of a sudden turned off, and I'm not expecting that's going to happen, but we are in a period of solar minimal activity. We have been for a long time. The solar conditions have been very weak for the past 12 years, really, the last probably longer, the last 14 years. The solar conditions have been fairly weak. And we went through a solar minimum that was unprecedented. We had over 600 days without any sunspots, almost 2 years without sunspots. And that's the indicator of some type of normal activity with the sun. But anyway, back to how the sun works, the solar wind. The sun is basically in a superatom state because of the fusion process. The electrons from the hydrogen atoms are in orbits, basically around the positively charged surface of the sun, and basically you have a super atom situation. That's where the what we call the solar corona, that's where that comes from. It's a sea of relativistic electrons that surround the sun. And when the explosions, the fusion explosions occur in the sun, the hydrogen clouds lift up to the surface. They see that electron cloud. They are accelerated towards it. They break a hole through that electron cloud, and they go blasting out into space. That is the solar wind. And they keep, the solar wind keeps going until it gets out far beyond the region of the orbit of Pluto, and it holds back a vast nebular cloud out there. It sweeps out the area and keeps all of this material out beyond the orbit of Pluto in a large donut-shaped capacitor. That's the solar capacitor that when comets or foreign objects come into the solar system, it discharges that capacitor, and that's what a comet is. It's the discharge of that solar capacitor. Earth, all of the other planets are discharging that solar capacitor constantly, and that is the source of the auroras, not some magnetic bubble that comes off the sun. But it's just bizarre to see scientists in standard science that have very poor physics backgrounds. And so when they learn something, they learned it in a textbook, they repeat it, and they don't know enough to question it. It's like meteorologists. Meteorologists are people that learned how to read from a teleprompter to read the weather information. But that information comes from some other source. They could be telling you that the moon has made out of blue cheese, and if it said that on the teleprompter, that's what they would read for you to hear. Okay, a rather strange character in Mayan and Aztec archaeology is what they call Chacmool. And that's really a French name. They really didn't have what you would call a Mayan or an Aztec name. But it's a very characteristically European figure. Now, remember that the Mayans and the Aztecs were typically short. They had foreheads. Many of them were forced at birth with two boards. They would put boards, one in front of the forehead, one behind the forehead, and they would tie them together with ropes to force the forehead back. And then they had this characteristic big, very exaggerated hooked nose. They were short. The Mayans, in fact, were extremely short. If you go to the cities, the Chichen Itza, Tulum, those cities, they had to be extremely short. And their descendants, the Lacandon Indians, who I had the good fortune to meet down there when they were still in their native state, living in the jungles back in the early 1970s, the women they looked like little birds. They were about 3 feet 9 inches tall, and the men were slightly larger. Very Aztec, very Mayan looking, and these were the descendants still living in the jungles of Yucatan and Quintana Roo and Belize and that area, still living in the jungles. So these were very small characteristic. The way they looked was very characteristic of that culture. Now, you look at the cities, whether it's Chichen Itza, they had them also Teotihuacan in Mexico with the Aztecs, Chichen Itza being in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. If you look at Tulum, if you look at the major cities of the Mayas, which grew out of the Olmecs, the very ancient, there is this character that is tall and European looking. Looks like a tall 6'5" Scandinavian guy. And not only is he there, but he's prominent. He's in the centermost religious ceremony region of the city. He's sitting on his back with his head kind of propped up with his sitting on his elbows. Now, if you can look at this. Go on the internet. You'll see many pictures. If you Chacmool, Chacmool is the typical spelling. I've seen it spelt many different ways depending on who you talk to. But Chacmool is a French name for this character. And anyway, he's perched up on a platform. He's sitting on kind of his behind, and half of his back is touching the platform. But he's arched up with his chest going forward and then his head vertically upward from this kind of back, arched back position. His arms, his elbows are down on the platform, but his arms are up over his stomach holding a small offertorial dish. His knees are up towards his chest and his feet and ankles come down with a locked in very position where his feet are flat on the ground, so he's just kind of like very kind of a scrunched position, feet flat on the ground. And what's interesting is, especially at the, for example, the Chichen Itzan site, he has characteristic tall moccasins with fringes on his feet, the moccasins coming all the way up to his knees. Some of the other sites, he has different types of shoes on, but typically not the kind of shoes you would find on a Mayan or Aztec. Sometimes he's dressed in kind of a ceremonial robe with some engraving, other times more simply. But characteristically, his head is turned 90 degrees to the left and looking off towards the west, towards the setting sun. The use by the modern Aztec and the modern Maya, which the modern Maya were around 800 to 1300 AD, and of course the Aztecs were all the way up to when the Spanish came in the 1500s, the ceremonial bowl on Chacmool's stomach was used when they cut the heart out of a sacrificial victim. They would put the heart in Chacmool's bowl as a, like I say, a sacrificial offering. But if you take a look at this, now Chacmool also has this funny little hat on that looks like, once again, kind of a European little bonnet type of hat. But if you look at his face, he's not Mayan, he's not Inca, he's not Aztec, he's not anything. Like I say, this is a 6'6" Scandinavian guy sitting in the center of a Mayan or Aztec ceremonial site, in the central position. Wow, what a strange situation. But obviously this character is set up to look to the west. And so the idea is that, you know, apparently he's looking for something possibly to come back. But back in the early 1990s, probably about 1990, about the mid-90s, I'd say, I went down there with some surveying equipment, and I decided I wanted to do my own surveying of these sites. I also wanted to search out into the jungle away from the cities where nobody really had spent any time looking, and look for surveying markers that would have been left. Because typically when you survey a site, but you go off into the distance and you set up survey markers. These survey markers are set up so that you have a very exacting reference point when you're shooting the north, east, south, and west lines. And for example, in both my calendar, my recalendar Sun Star Clock, or in the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, that when I talk about building a calendar and setting up the primary directions north, east, south, and west, which is part of your clock system, I talk about going off far into the distance and putting a marker stone so that you can, those are used for very exacting positions of north, east, south, and west. So at any rate, I did that, and I went looking around out in the jungle outside of Chichen Itza, and sure enough, I found the north, south, east, and west markers. The only problem is they were about 13.5 degrees off of true north, south, east, and west. And now this is not magnetic. This is surveying with the true north, the adjusted North Star north, or there's other ways of determining north. But I had exact north, and I had the old-style transit surveying equipment, and I had a person with me assisting, holding the poles, and so we did basically surveyed the archaeological sites down there. But what's strange is that the survey markers are very off base, according to our current north, south, east, and west, the positions of north, south, east, and west that we have today. So the question is, first of all, where does this Shock Mool guy come in? And by the way, he's set up in a position to look towards the western survey markers, not towards true west. Well, for a city like Chichen Itza that's built on the whole concept of the sun, clearly they would want to build this up with a true north, south, east, and west. So the question is, what exactly happened here? Okay, so talking a little bit about, first of all, Shock Mool is not pointed towards what we would call northeast, south, and west directions today. If you understand where he is pointed to, you realize that something has changed. Something drastic has changed. The observatory, this is a very telling situation. The observatory at Chichen Itza is aligned with the pyramid, the Temple of the Feathered Serpent, and it has nothing to do with northeast, south, and west. But why would they build the observatory on any coordinates other than northeast, south, and west? Well, this is, of course, an absurdity at best. And so the whole situation is that after the great catastrophe, the Mayan cities, and there were basically cities all around the world that were already built, that were thriving. I like the fact that Noah's Flood movie that just came out called Noah. They make a great point of stating that in those days prior to the Great Flood, there was a very large population of humans on Earth. The cities, the city sprawl, the disaster, the economic disaster that came before the flood. And remember that the flood was thousands of years prior to what I call the Moses event. The Moses event was when Venus, the planet, the comet, came through the solar system that eventually formed the planet Venus. But that was the event, that was the Moses event, that really took and gave us a pole shift. The Noah's event, remember, did not give us a pole shift. It was simply 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain while we passed through the tail of a large comet. And so, at any rate, when they rebuilt the cities, and this is the main point, eventually the legends of Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky related to Venus, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus, these are the legends that are passed down to us through the Popol Vuh of the Mayans, that the cities, when they were rebuilt eventually, and they started rebuilding them at the time, but the cities that we see today, the layered cities that are pyramid on top of pyramid on top of pyramid, that reached their zenith during the 800 to 1300 year period AD in the Mayans, and of course later with the Aztecs, these cities were rebuilt on the old gridwork, the gridwork that was prior to the great catastrophe. So that's why this took a long time to sort out. But if you were going to build a city especially one based on the sun and the primary directions, northeast, south, and west, you would have it pointing in a northeast, southwest direction, and you would have your main character who's looking at the western setting sun, you would have him looking west, not off in some direction, 13.5 degrees off of west. That doesn't correspond with anything. That doesn't correspond with any aspect of astronomy or anything else. It's the simple fact is that they were building the city. It's like if, say, New York City was destroyed by some type of natural event. And thousands, hundreds of years later, 1,000 years later, people came back to rebuild it. They're not going to change all the streets and all the primary directions. They're going to build it on the same grid work that they would discover there. And so that's the same situation. So the Mayans and the Aztecs built their cities on the old grid works. And then you find some of the cities that were built later actually are true to north, east, south, and west. Ones that were built out, apparently, if they were built on a site of an older city, they adapted the true north, south, east, and west directions that we have today. If you look at Chichen Itza and you follow it to its logical conclusion, so to speak, if you take a line along the grid work of the city along the north, east, south, and west line of the city, you find that those lines, the north line, points up to a point in southern Ontario. And that's where the old North Pole was. So, at any rate, it's very important to understand that the structures that we see in archaeology reflect, in some cases, the ancient the positioning of the celestial sphere, the north, east, south, and west that were there before the pole shift. It's very important. I have a 2-CD set that's been very popular over the years. It's called The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. It's a 2-CD set that I go into a lot of detail. One of the episodes is on Noah's Flood. Another episode is on one of the main themes in this 18 hours of lectures on the 2-CD set. One of the main themes that I talk about is the Venus event. And this is one of the most formative events in the history of man, but it's not taught or acknowledged in Western or any type of modern society. There are other ancient societies that talk about it, that as part of their mythology, you might say. But this has been totally canceled as a basis for human religion, for basis for human culture, for basic evolutionary biology, and the division of the races. When I was teaching astronomy at the university level, I would come into a class, and it was usually like in the springtime, the students weren't there, they didn't want to be there, and they were in class, but their minds weren't there. And so I said, this is a what you call a long hair day. It's a day when nobody wants to really do much. And so I said, okay, close your books. We're doing something different. And so they'd kind of perk up and listen. I said, okay, we would start. I described this in, I believe, one of my books, possibly the Atlantis to Tesla book. But I'd say, okay, think we're going to play a little game here, kind of a history game. And I'd say, think of something that wasn't here last week. Basically they fixed a road, somebody cut down a tree, and so some student would come up with something that had changed since last week. And so, okay, that's great. How about a month ago? What has changed in your environment? A new house went up, or, something changed a month ago. And so somebody would come up with an idea of, a new building got built downtown, or something that had changed since a month ago, or a building was torn down, whatever it was. Okay, then I said, go back 6 months. And so then we start going back into history. I said, okay, go back 10 years. And then I would go back prior to when any of these people were born, 50, 100 years ago. And what was it like here? It was, you know, so people had to create the environment. The American Native Indians were still living here. Man was pushing west through the Americas. The cities were not here. People were using basically other modes of transportation. You know, 150 years, 200 years, 500 years. What was Europe like 1,000 years ago? You had the Black Forest still. You had the basically the various, the coming and going of the Holy Roman Empire. You know, what did Europe look like back then? What were the population centers? And then you go back farther, 1,000 years, 2,000, 3,000 years, and you realize that these population centers in Japan, in China, India, were totally isolated before Marco Polo found the route to the east, before ships had crossed the southern tip of Africa, before Vasco da Gama had made his great voyages to establish contact with other parts of the world. Before these contacts were made, those population centers were where they were. And they had lost communication. It's like we didn't even know those areas of the world existed. And so what was going on? The people were rediscovering population centers. And so then we come back to the point of, okay, now in history, when you learned history as a student, whether you were in grade school or high school honors history, whatever, university level, you were taught that man crossed the Bering Strait. Somehow all life began in Mesopotamia and branched outwards. But then the question is, how did all of these isolated populations get there? The Chinese, who are different than the Japanese, who are different than the, you know, then you have the 6-foot-tall African black guy compared to the pygmies in Africa, compared to the Mayans over here and the Aztecs. And then you find out that in Peru they had civilizations of millions of people. There was a city on the western coast of Peru big enough to hold 40 million people before the Egyptian pyramids were built. So the students started to realize that everything they had been taught about history and the evolution of man was false. How could it be that all of this, these civilizations and cultures and races of people that were so diverse have come from one pocket of people 7,000 years ago in Mesopotamia? Well, you know, the whole thing is beyond absurd. So they started to get a bit angry because they were realizing they had been had. Everything they were taught was incorrect. So what was the real story? The real story was that there was a vast worldwide population. These populations existed, were trading amongst one another, and then all of a sudden there was a major worldwide disaster that caused them to be separated only to be discovered later by all of these various means. And so, at any rate, I sent them out to discover what the real history was, and then they went to the libraries, they couldn't find it, they got twice as mad. I'm about out of time here, but anyway, the point is that history is not as you have been told, let's put it that way. Remember to go to my website, the new water filters, the other water filter elements, the GF filters that take out all of the chemicals without the need for add-on filtration. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.